This episode is brought to you by Habit Aware. My Keen 2 brings awareness to my trichotillomania by giving my wrist a gentle hug or vibration when I'm doing the scanning behavior. Bring awareness into your life by visiting barbaralally.com/habitaware and use code LALLYLOVE for 10% off.
My name is Sahara Dixon. I have trichotillomania, which is hair pulling disorder, and I began pulling. I began pulling probably around the age of like 9 or 10. I started pulling from my head, more so like around like my edges, like the, I guess the very top of my head, if you will. And then also like my nether regions, which I feel like whenever folks talk about trichotillomania, no one really ever is like obviously as candid about like pulling out from there, but that is primarily where I pulled, especially around that time. It was puberty. I was growing hair in all sorts of very interesting places. And so for me, that was a big marker that, you know, I was doing something that was very different from what the other girls at the at that age were doing. And yeah, that's primarily how I got started.
Do you have a memory of around the first time you pulled from either area and like what was going on in your mind during that time?
Honestly, I don't like quite remember exactly. Like, I could not pinpoint exactly like what the foundational moment was for me starting. But I do remember the first time that it was like pointed out to me. I lived like very close to my grandparents. They lived like literally right on the same street, a couple houses down from me. And so I would be there all the time. They would babysit us, or my mom and my dad were, you know, out at work or just doing whatever. I remember one time I had my hands down my pants, and my grandfather would always be like, "Girl, what are you doing? Digging for gold down there? Get your hands out your pants." And I think before that, like, I really had no sense or understanding of like what shame or stigma was as it related to like hair pulling in my BFRB. But I think the more like family started pointing that out, and again, having those like moments where it was being, yeah, really pointed out, I think that's when I kind of started understanding that like what I was doing was actually not something normal, and that other people saw it as something that was wrong.
At what point did you find out that there was a name for the behavior you were doing?
Ooh, girl. I think it was like maybe right before high school, honestly. So I would say probably around like 13, 14, maybe 15, around that age is when I started getting really interested in just being on the computer. We didn't have like Wi-Fi in my house growing up, so I would always go to the library to do my assignments for school. And this is around the time where I feel like teachers, educators were really starting to implement like using Google and using search engines and such in like the education realm. And so we didn't have like a computer or Wi-Fi growing up in the household. And so by the time we actually got Wi-Fi and a computer in the house, I want to say, yeah, I was starting high school. And that's when, you know, when you have a computer, you have quite literally all the information that you would want at your fingertips. And so, you know, I'm playing games on the computer. I'm doing all sorts of things on the computer. And I think just one time, I probably was just very curious and interested to see what the internet had to say about people pulling out their hair. And then voila, all the resources came pouring out. And I realized that I had a BFRB and that I had trichotillomania.
How did it make you feel to find out that there was a name?
It was definitely very cathartic, I think, in the moment, especially because I think I have grown up just feeling very isolated in all senses of the word. I grew up in predominantly white spaces. I was always the only Black person or person of color in a room. And so, you know, I was the Black sheep in the family. I was very quirky. I'm queer, you know, all these different things. And so I was always used to being like the oddball out. And so to finally like find that this behavior that I've been doing for years at this point, or at that point, of was something that other people did. It was very like, wow, like I'm not strange. I'm not, you know, there's nothing inherently wrong with me. Like, there are other people who share this lived experience. And it just brought me a lot of like relief. But I think once the relief settled, then I was kind of like, okay, like how do I manage this? Like, what can I do about this? And I think still at the time I was very secretive about it. So I think that relief was very short-lived, at least, yeah, at least while I was in high school trying to, get all the things together in my life.
Before you found that there was a name for it and maybe eventually resources for it, what were some things that you tried to do to maybe lessen your pulling?
I think when I was a kid and a teenager, I don't think there was much of anything that I was trying really. I think I was more so just like trying to not do it in front of people. I think when I was first starting out, I did it like in front of people. I would have my hands in my pants in front of like my family and my hands in my hair in front of my family. And very quickly, I learned that, like, okay, that's a no. People are pointing it out. I feel weird that they're pointing it out. That's shame. I don't want to feel that. So then I just started kind of doing it in like secret, which ultimately led me to like start pulling from other places that I felt like could be easier to hide or do it like in private. So there wasn't really anything that I had originally started doing. Like this, the idea of like stopping or trying to stop was a very foreign concept for me.
Did you ever think about or end up seeking help from a professional, maybe a therapist, psychiatrist?
So when I was younger, I tell this story all the time. When I was younger, I was actually battling quite, I don't want to say a lot, but I was definitely having a moment of just like extreme depression and anxiety growing up. I think it certainly grew from the environments that I was in, but also the household that I was in. My parents chronically fought all the time. I couldn't really show up as my true authentic self in front of my family all of the time. There was a lot of religious trauma that I was navigating, in addition to all the trauma that I was kind of endearing or enduring rather, in school as the only person of color, the only Black person in a lot of these spaces. I think for me, it was really difficult. And so for the longest time, I could tell like something was wrong, like emotionally. I had a really hard time like channeling my emotions and processing them. And then as I got older, I realized that I have PMDD and ADHD in addition to trichotillomania. I didn't know that growing up, obviously. So I think I just really genuinely thought that like I was just like crazy. And so there were moments where like I would have these like really extreme bouts of like depression or just sadness or really having a hard time of being understood. And there would be a few times that I would like reach out to my mom or reach out to my dad and like try to vocalize like, hey, I'm not feeling that great. I feel like really sad. I feel really depressed. Some suicidal ideation there that like ultimately like this was my way of reaching out and trying to get help. But growing up in the household that I did, growing up in a very religious household, my mom was basically kind of like, and I love my mom, but she didn't really have the resources, I feel like, well enough to kind of be dealing with what I was dealing with, let alone all of the stuff that she was dealing with. And so she was kind of like, why would you wish that on yourself? Why are you talking about those things? Like, we go to church every Sunday. Like, you just need to like put it on the altar. And then I think I felt so like just triggered by that, that I think one time I went to our school nurse in high school. I was probably like 14 at the time. And at least where I was, every year the nurse had to kind of just do like a physical assessment. So one of the questions on the form was like, do you feel like depressed? How often? Your typical depression scale. And I remember filling that out, and I guess I scored low enough that like the nurse called me in just to like check in. And I remember just like being like kind of gaslit into like, I was like, yeah, though I feel depressed, but like the nurse was kind of like, well, kids like you don't really like really get depressed. So I think you're just maybe having a bad week, just really checking in more so just to check a box. And I think for me, I felt that was very limiting, I think, for me, because I didn't seek out therapy until well after I finished my bachelor's degree. So I didn't really get therapy for my BFRB or any therapy period, until I was about 23, 24.
I can't believe kids like you. What do you mean?
I mean, it was very, it was a lot. And I think in the moment, I didn't even know what she meant by that. In hindsight, now that I do all the work that I do now, I can very easily pinpoint what she meant, right? And also, despite all of that, why are you not doing your job? Like, you are here to serve like the betterment of the student body. And you could have very easily have given me a referral to a mental health specialist. I don't think it was you, as the school nurse, to be the one to say, okay, yes or no, she needs further help. Like, let the professionals, rule whatever out. And so for a long time, I just learned to kind of like shove it in. I didn't, I didn't really think much of it. I just thought that I was just going to just be depressed and sad and cry all the time, just forever. And it really wasn't until my dad got really sick that I even attempted to go to therapy when I was about 24. During the pandemic, he got really sick, and I had reached out to a therapist for something else. I felt like I had just like PTSD from my dad having like seizures all the time. And then they ended up diagnosing me with trichotillomania, which I already knew I had. I just never had a formal diagnosis. And so then I had started therapy for trich because I had reached out to a therapist for a whole different reason. So I had never even thought to like go and even seek therapy for my trich. It just so happened to be that because all these things were kind of hitting ahead at once, loneliness with the pandemic, my father being sick, and then I think I was pulling, obviously I was pulling a lot more because of all that. That kind of made me seek out therapy more. And, I wasn't on my, no, I was still on my mom's insurance, but, I was an adult now, and I could take full responsibility over my mental health. And I was like, I don't care if she sees the bill or the bill code. I was like, I'm getting this therapy, because if I'm going to be living at home helping take care of my dad, then like I need like support too. And so it was all very much like a very like come to Jesus moment for me.
Did you find that the therapy for your trichotillomania, did it help at all?
Certainly, I think it certainly helped. I went to like I forget what it's called, but it's like the Emotional Center in Philly. But they had a South Jersey location, and I know like Dr. Diebler does a lot of work with like trich and OCD and things like that. So I believe that is or was her practice, Dr. Marla Diebler. And so I was really grateful to be like, because I was in South Jersey at the time. So I was really grateful to be like in close proximity to like this practice that was doing really phenomenal, work with folks who had BFRBs. So I started learning a lot just about like the biology and chemistry around like hair pulling. As a researcher, I find like that knowing like the why and how is like really important to me, and just feeling like normal and like understanding that, yeah, the biology behind it. But also, it was really helpful in just being able to really like, that was the first time that I had really sat down and reflected on like, when do I do it? Why do I do it? How do I do it? How often? And really like mapping out and tracking like when and where. Like, that was the first time that I feel like I had really sat down very intimately with my BFRB and just like really interrogated it. Like, why am I doing this thing? And so then I started learning that like, oh, there's other things happening in my life that I feel like my BFRB is trying to soothe in a way. And ultimately, that led me to get a lot more curious about all the other things that, again, at this point, still, I had only been diagnosed with the trichotillomania, and I was diagnosed with anxiety. But as the years went on, I got more curious about the anxiety diagnosis because I didn't feel like it really told the whole story. And then later, that led me to my PMDD and my ADHD diagnosis. And so I think it definitely helped. And, there was plenty of tools that I learned to just really learn about not taking so much shame and stigma and carrying it with me, letting that go, and trying different tools and tips, and ultimately just being more aware of why I'm doing it so that I'm more aware in trying to stop it or just understanding why I'm doing this thing. So it was very helpful in that regards. But I think after a while, like I said, my father was still sick at the time. I was dealing with interpersonal stuff, and so there was a moment where I felt like treating my trick is great, but there's so many other things that I need to address that my trick interweaves with, right? And so I was like, I need a little bit more than just the trick therapy, just the BFRB therapy. And so that ultimately I ended that relationship, and I was getting off of insurances anyway, so I wasn't going to be covered through them anymore. And I ended up moving to start my PhD. That's when I found another therapist who, yeah, has been still my therapist till this day.
Did you know Habit Aware also offers virtual peer coaching? This one-to-one peer-based program will coach you through shifting mindset, practicing healthy strategies, and creating your personal roadmap to recovery. To work with me, Ellen, or Anila, head over to habitaware.com/coaching today. For people who are listening, is there one or two things that you do now, maybe on a regular basis, that helps you manage your BFRB, something that you would kind of go back to?
I think ultimately for me, it is awareness, which sounds so simple, but like I said before, I had no understanding of anything, right? Mental health related, but especially as it relates to trichotillomania and BFRBs. And so I think awareness has literally been my best friend. And so I think ultimately just sitting in stillness sometimes, and even if I do pull or pick, I have the awareness to kind of snap myself out of that trance. I know I'm sure you get all the time that some folks with trick or BFRBs kind of talk about it as it's like a trance-like state. For me, I would just kind of get in that trance and then just stay in it. But now I have like, I'm so in tune with my body now that like I can at the very least understand like when I'm doing it or like snap myself out of it. So I think really getting clear on the where, when, how often, what happened that day, were there any stressors that day? Were there any points of joy that day that didn't let you to lead you to pull so much? I think really getting clear on that. And then ultimately from there, you are able to find tips, tricks, resources that are for you because yes, we all have the shared experience, the symptomatology. Like, yes, people with trichotillomania, we all pull our hair out, but it's very case by case basis as to like why, is it boredom? Are you stressed? Are you anxious? Is it a self-soothing tactic? Are you neurodivergent? Is that like a stim for you? There's lots of different things that I think kind of go into it. So I think for me, ultimately, my advice would just be to get very clear on why you're doing it for you and backtracking from there.
You mentioned earlier that you were pretty secretive about your trichotillomania. What led you to be more open?
Yeah. I think for many of us, we didn't know we were doing a thing that others were doing, right? So being connected to like orgs like the TLC Foundation, for example, growing up, like I said before, was very life-changing. But as I got older and became more aware of like how the world works for someone who looks like me and lives like I do, I was almost hyper aware of the fact that all these resources, and mind you, there weren't that many, but I was very hyper aware that all these resources were very, very white, in the white gaze, and that I really couldn't see myself reflected at all. So even the few resources that I had found for people of color, Black women, Black people especially, they were so extremely limited and almost outdated. And I felt like they were geared towards like older women. At the time, I was like maybe 25 and, very much a young adult for all intents and purposes. And so, like, reading things about like Black women in their 50s, that did not resonate with me whatsoever. As someone who is in public health or who was trying to get into public health at the time, pursuing my career, I realized that, I just wanted to open the doors up and like find my people. And it wasn't about being the first to do anything. Like, yes, the Imani BFRB group was the first Black support group internationally, I'm pretty sure, that was just geared towards Black folks who had lived a diasporic experience. But it wasn't about like doing, it wasn't about the accolades, it wasn't about doing things to be able to say that I'm the first. I think for me, selfishly, it was just about finding my people, finding other people, whether they were men, women, whoever, who shared this experience with me. And so I needed community with people who truly understood my experiences, not just the trichotillomania, not just the dermatillomania, but all of my experiences being Black, being gay, being queer, being neurodivergent, right? I needed to be in community with people who understood those intersections and how that made us show up differently than a lot of my white counterparts. And so ultimately, that is truly what was the touching point for me to begin sharing my story, was just wanting to kind of share it so that other people could be like, oh, who is this person? Let's connect. And then it ultimately became this whole movement, if you will. But that's ultimately why I started sharing my story. I just wanted to find my people, man. You know, I wanted to be, I had never even physically in person met anyone up until this point who had a BFRB. And so, yeah, I just wanted to be in community, albeit virtual, with other Black folks with BFRBs. And if telling my story had to get that started, then telling my story, I did.
And then how can people join your support group and like learn about your foundation if you don't mind like plugging all that information now?
Yeah, of course. So I'm sure you know, but so the Imani BFRB support group has been around, I want to say until like since like 2020, 2021. So it's been around for a little bit now. And it was very active in the beginning, but as life went on and I'm finishing up my PhD, you know, my capacity has really diminished. And so I wanted a way to almost continue Imani in perpetuity. And so I was thinking of ways to maybe turn it into a nonprofit, have a working board. But if any of y'all know, it is very hard to start a nonprofit. And as someone who has just left an executive director position with a nonprofit, I was like, whoo, I don't think I can go through all of that again. And so I was very happy to partner with BFRB Changemakers, and they are going to serve as our fiscal sponsor. So we won't be our own standalone foundation, if you will, but we will be moving and functioning just as a regular nonprofit or a foundation would be, with all the resources for Black folks, not only Black folks, but just people of color in general who live with, struggle with BFRBs. And so we do have an Instagram account, and it is at Imani BFRB. That's Imani BFRB. And that's primarily where we share most of our information, most of our resources. We are working on building out a website. So I'm really excited, super excited for that. It'll be the landing page. Right now, we've just been, yeah, utilizing Instagram and our newsletter. But hopefully by the end of the summer, the website should be up and running. And it's also coinciding with a lot of my dissertation research that I'm doing. So I'm very happy to kind of continue doing these digital storytelling workshops as a part of a foundation. And yeah, that so if you want to learn more and support, definitely follow Imani BFRB on Instagram. You can always reach out to me, and we can, yeah, we can get it. We can get it talking. We can get it popping.
So it's funny, I have your picture framed on my wall because I have the article, the New York Times. So I look at you all the time because I was in, you know, I have like a little section in the paragraph. How did it feel to see you in the New York Times sharing your experience?
Girl, that was a very surreal moment. I think, yeah, it all came together so quickly that like it didn't, I don't even think I was so busy at the time with like when I did the interview that it didn't even really like dawn on me. Like I knew, I was like, oh, like the New York Times, that's cool. But I don't think it really sat, I don't think it really dawned on me how transformative and empowering and how radical it was to be in the New York Times until it got published. And then, like, you know, as you know, there's multiple people featured in the article. And so, like, looking at your social media, for example, looking at Sarah's social media, for example, and even mine, when I posted it, like looking through the comments and seeing all the other people feeling seen and heard, I was just like, wow, this is actually like a very big moment. And like, yeah, it's so cool that I'm in the New York Times. Like, how many people get to say that? And also, I felt like it was such an important opportunity just to like talk more about BFRBs and share our stories and really just help people feel less alone. And that's ultimately my motto through all of this, through sharing my story, through doing the coaching that I do, through the Imani BFRB Foundation, right? All of these things ultimately is to help people feel less alone. And I think it's great that that took the shape of a New York Times article. But ultimately, like that, like I feel so proud and I feel so happy that really could come. It felt like a 180, 360 moment, a full circle moment. I was like, here, this little black girl who struggled with all these sorts of things, and no one was listening to me, and no one was hearing me, and everyone didn't care about what I was going through. And then it's like, wow, I have this experience where like now millions, billions of people can read my story now, and I don't have to worry about people discrediting it. Like, it is what it is. It's written, it's done, and it's helping so many other people. And so I think that's the beauty behind things like that. So yeah, I'm really happy about it.
It's so awesome. And I think what really stands out to me, like you mentioned, the comments that people, no matter who's posting it, all of the comments are like, me too, me too. I can't believe someone's talking about this. For years of my life, most of my experience with trichotillomania, I thought if I shared it, people are going to say, ew, oh my gosh, you're so weird, you're so disgusting. And it just proves that that's not true. That self-talk, that negative self-talk that we get, like, say to ourselves, it's lying. Like, no, people want to hear our story because they're experiencing it too, and they want to relate.
I think for me, it was very healing to my inner child. Like you said, I think prior to getting as vocal about my BFRB as I am now, like I would have never imagined I would be like telling the New York Times that I pulled out my pubic hair, right? Like that was a very vulnerable moment for me, full stop. And I had almost had like a moment where I freaked out that I was like, oh my God, wait, that got published? Like what? Like what? But then I was like, wait, no, this is such a privilege to be able to share this story and know that like I know as a BFRB researcher and someone who does this work that like there are so many other people who pull from there too, right? We might just not be saying it because it is very much like a like gross factor of like why would you be doing that? But for me, I was just like, there are other people who are like probably crying somewhere, like, wow, like I feel so seen. She's so brave for sharing this part. And then I almost like took it down off of my Instagram page because I was like spiraling a little bit. And then the comments from like people who I know, like in real life, started trickling in, like, wow, like you are so brave for sharing your story. You are so, like, I can't believe how open and vulnerable you are. Like, all those affirmations felt so good to me. And I knew, like, I was like, girl, what am I doing? Keep that story up and be proud of, like, where you've come from and where you're going. And that was very healing for my inner child, for sure, especially considering that, like, I've been continuously reaching out for help and hadn't really got it until I was, like, a full-fledged adult. And so, yeah, that was a very transformational moment. I'm just so happy that we could like share it all together. And I had been following you for a while, but I hadn't really known about like a lot of your work until like very recently. I would say maybe the past month or two. And so I was like, wow, this is so sick that we're all just like sharing this moment together. And we all have had very similar reactions to it. We're all around the same age. We all have very similar stories about finding out and how we got started. And, so I think that's just the beauty of it, really. Like, no matter like black, white, no matter what, like that, I just love being in community with people who share a lived experience with me, and we can all just like support and love each other and just live life.